Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from Space Beans Coffee, committed to fueling the daily journey from morning grogginess to the peak of productivity, offering a variety of brews, including Go for Launch, Dark Side of the Moon, Rocket to Mars, and more. Available at their Melbourne cafe or online at spacebeans.com.
Getting swole in space and a decades-old mission billions of miles away. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brennan Byrne. Working out on the International Space Station is essential to crew health and for research, but as humans venture to the moon and eventually Mars, how will they get exercise? The ISS is large enough to hold two treadmills, but the spacecraft for long-duration missions will be much smaller. So how important is exercise? We'll speak with NASA's Stuart Lee about NASA's treadmill study. Then, launched over four decades ago, the Voyager mission has traveled over 29 billion miles. Originally, it was only supposed to last 7 years, but engineers and scientists have worked to keep Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 going by turning off some of the systems. We'll speak with Voyager's Kareem Badaruddin about Voyager 1 and 2 and how the team is trying to keep the spacecraft alive. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? On Earth, people can walk into the gym, break a sweat, and get a great workout in. But when there's no gravity, how do you run on a treadmill, lift weights, or ride a bike? NASA and international partners have designed various equipment so astronauts and other crew members can work out during their stay on the ISS. But as humans venture on long-duration missions, including to the moon and eventually Mars, taking bulky gym equipment is tricky, especially on a large treadmill. So now, scientists and researchers are studying how important a treadmill is to human health in space. Here to talk about this exercise research called the Zero-T2 study is Stuart Lee, the Associate Element Scientist for the Human Health Countermeasures Element at NASA's Human Research Program. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you about this. You know, exercise on the International Space Station has been vital. I want to talk about some of the exercise equipment that's currently on the space station right now that we see these astronauts using. If you look up a picture of it, they look a little wacky compared to some of the exercise equipment we have here on Earth. So, Stuart, can you walk me through some of that equipment?
The first thing we use are cyclergometers. We've actually got two cyclergometers on the International Space Station. One is called the velogometer. It's provided by the Russian Space Agency. And then the second is a cyclergometer. You'll hear it referred to as CVIS, a cyclergometer with vibration isolation system. And this is true for our other pieces of hardware. So the vibration isolation system is not something that you would typically see in the gym, obviously. When you're exercising, whether it's on the treadmill or the cyclergometer or even a resistive exercise device, you're imparting forces into the vehicle. When you're on the ground, it's really no big deal. But in space, the vibrations from the exercise going through the vehicle put stresses on the joints of the space station or whatever space vehicle we're talking about. So vibration isolation is a big topic for us. The two treadmills we have on station, we have, again, a Russian-provided treadmill, and then you'll hear referred to as T2, which is our treadmill with vibration isolation system, same idea. The fun thing about the treadmill is in zero gravity. Anytime you push off anything, you obviously push your body away. And if you tried to run on a treadmill without any way to keep yourself on the treadmill, you'd just step and you'd float away. Wouldn't be much exercise. What we do is we have crew members wear, we call it a harness. It's actually based on a backpacking shoulder strap and hip system so that you can then attach bungees to that. And that's what holds you to the treadmill. The most unusual piece of exercise equipment, people have seen cyclergometers in gyms and treadmills in gyms, is our advanced resistive exercise device, or what we call ARED. When you're in the gym, you can pick up a weight and you can do your exercise. But of course, in weightlessness, microgravity, the weight doesn't really matter that much. You can move big things. So in order to provide resistive exercise in flight, it's a vacuum cylinder. It's got a piston attached to it, a rod. And when you pull out on that piston, of course, you're now creating, there's force required in order to draw that out. And that's how we provide resistive exercise to our crew members.
Stuart, I know that
some of the crew members on the ISS are participating in what is called a ZRT2 study. And this study is basically testing how important these treadmills are. Part of the reason is because we've got some long duration missions coming up. Tell me a little bit about this trial and just a little bit about why it's important.
All our astronauts are required to perform exercise almost every day in space. For the NASA crew members, they typically exercise 6 days a week and tend to take one day off. And they'll do a mixture of aerobic exercise and resistance exercise using the devices I described earlier. This takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours a day, their normal work day. All the astronauts perform some amount of exercise every day. The exercise programs that we use on the International Space Station have evolved over a number of years. There's a general consensus over the years that treadmill exercise is particularly important. A treadmill is your way to replicate that you normally walk around on the ground, and so that you're prepared when we're talking about exploration missions going to the moon and Mars, that you're still comfortable with walking. But the problem is when we go into these exploration missions, we're going to have a very limited space. And treadmill, as you can imagine in your mind, takes up a lot of space in the vehicle. The big question is, do we really need a treadmill? How important is that to our exploration missions? So this particular study, we're going to compare astronauts who perform the normal ISS protocols, the ones I mentioned earlier, and then there will be one group that will not perform the treadmill exercise. They'll do the cyclergometer and they'll use the resistive exercise device. And so we'll do testing with them before their flight. Of course, we get a baseline measurement. In flight, we'll do a series of muscle strength and aerobic tests. And we'll also look a little bit at the bone metabolism. And then post-flight, we'll do some of those same tests that we did pre-flight. So we can track their fitness from before the mission, during the mission, and soon thereafter. And there's also some nerve vestibular or sensory motor, like balance tests, to see how people react, comparing people who used the treadmill to those who didn't. And then there's a third group that we're planning using the planned exploration exercise device, which combines several modalities or, you know, some aerobic and resistive exercise into one device, but it's more compact. It would fit more readily in a capsule or a vehicle that we would take to the moon or to Mars. By comparing all these groups, we figure out how important the treadmill exercise is, and then we also understand how important or how well the currently planned exercise device for those missions. The other thing that I think is exciting about this particular study is that we're using some testing modalities that are potential uses in exploration missions. So we can monitor what exercise they do, but we'd also like to know about what effects that have on muscle and bone, for example, during the space flight. We're looking at some bone biomarkers for muscle. Typically, you think about using MRI, the big magnets. In this case, we're actually using ultrasound in order to measure muscle volume, which is a unique application. I think one of the exciting things about the space program is our folks are very creative in using modalities like that we would use on the ground and applying them in space. And conversely, work that we do in order to make them functional in space and sometimes miniaturize then feeds back into the general medical practices that are performed in everyday life.
We've interviewed some astronauts on the show before, and they've said sometimes when they come back down, you know, your legs feel a little bit like jelly. You're kind of learning how to walk again for a second, you know, because you've been in space for such a long time, months and months, with possibly the thought of not having a treadmill, if that's the route that the study shows. Do you think that there would be another piece of equipment that could kind of replace that for that walking, that kind of running? I mean, it kind of connects the astronauts too, to their livelihoods on Earth, right?
Think about the times that you have the flu, or, you know, you've had a significant medical condition that you've been in bed for several days, you haven't gotten up. And then the first time you get up, that kind of the weak-kneed feeling, some people get a little lightheaded. And that's essentially what the astronauts feel. Sometimes some get it worse than others. The idea of being able to do something that approximates walking. This is obviously the reason we're doing the study. We want to test this out, how important it is. So some other things that might be planned for these missions would be some balance tasks. Again, probably using the bungees that we were talking about before for the treadmill. And then like a balance board, like you might see in a gym, and getting used to shifting your weight and how to control that. We could also do some marching exercises with something like that. And then another group has actually proposed that we do some jumping exercises. Obviously, it's a little different. We all do, you know, doing jump ropes and, you know, hopscotch and things like that. But it's also a very good activity for muscles. It's a strong stimulus. It's good for muscle strength and coordination. That's something that other people are really interested in. But as I was talking about earlier with the vibration isolation system, you can imagine the amount of pounding that would occur when you jump in space. On the Skylab mission, the last Skylab mission, which was America's space station back in the 1970s, the longest mission was 84 days. They used what was called a slick plate. So it was a piece of aluminum with a Teflon coating, again, using some bungee cords. They pushed or walked on that plate and the bungee cords held them in place. So if you think about if you're trying to move a piece of furniture that's really heavy, you lean into it, you start to push, and your feet slide across the carpet or the floor. And that's kind of what it is. You're trying to move your feet across the floor on pushing against an immovable object.
Fascinating. I think this will be my gym motivation for today.
What really excites me about this study is the study is designed to help us understand what types of exercise modalities will be needed for exploration missions when the size of our vehicle is much smaller than ISS. You know, the ISS is football field sized, and that's true whether you're talking about football in the United States or in Europe. That's a much larger space than we'll have in the Orion capsule. And so if you think about the actual space that they will have, it's like three or four school buses backed up to each other. And so that volume inside those school buses. When we're talking about Orion, in particular for going to the moon, it's much smaller. It's bigger than the Apollo capsule that we used, but it's not nearly as big as ISS. And so that's a real driver. This provides us one step closer to going on these exploration missions, the best way that we can protect them.
And not even for these long-term missions, right? But there is a big push for humans living and working in space or on different planets. You know, we see that whole thing of, well, we're going to be living on Mars soon. We're going to be living on the moon. This does step us closer to some of those theories, right? And some of those goals. It really does prepare us if humans do want to take that next step.
We are well designed to function in normal gravity, in 1G. And going to these other environments, it's a challenge because it's something different. When you think about the first time you do any activity, you're never an expert the first time you do it. And then on top of that, you are now in an environment which maybe puts stresses on your body in different ways and unstresses your body in different ways. So you're going to adapt to that. Human body is very plastic. That's probably not the right word, but you're very well adapt to different environments. So you need to, you know, but you need time. Nothing ever happens overnight.
Stuart, thank you so much for joining us to talk about exercise on the ISS and the Zero-T2 trial. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Stuart Lee, the Associate Element Scientist for the Human Health Countermeasures Element at NASA's Human Research Program. Still to come, a space miracle, the Voyager mission.
We should be so lucky that we get to the point that power is what gets us, that we just simply don't have enough.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brennan Byrne. Alcohol has been around for thousands of years and is an important part of human history and culture. While people have had champagne and celebratory drinks on board the ISS, there are strict rules about drinking in space. But what if people could drink normally in space just like here on Earth? The book Alcohol in Space and Now documentary dives into these ideas and explores several companies that are trying to produce alcohol in space. We'll talk more about drinks and brews and how it ties to space exploration next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about Voyager. Back in 1977, Voyager 1 and 2 launched on a mission to explore our solar system and the outer planets. But after about 48 years, the spacecraft have gone beyond their original mission and altogether have journeyed over 29 billion miles. But after four decades, the spacecraft are starting to show their age. But how do you fix a nearly half-century-old spacecraft that is billions of miles away from Earth? Here to talk about how scientists and engineers are working to keep the mission going is Kareem Badaruddin, the mission manager for the Voyager Interstellar Mission. Kareem, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
I'm really happy you're here to talk about Voyager 1 and 2. So recently, some of the systems were turned off. What were these systems that were turned off?
Voyager 1, we turned off the cosmic ray subsystem. It's an instrument that measures, obviously, galactic cosmic rays, galactic cosmic ray spectra, and changes in the energy spectra of certain elements like hydrogen and helium. And then the low energy charged particle instrument was turned off on Voyager 2. Prior to these turnoffs, we have the same suite of four instruments on both spacecraft. And when it came time to turn off, we thought about, you know, how can we keep at least one of the instruments on one of the spacecraft? And in the case of Voyager 1, it's the furthest out, you know, 15 billion miles or more, and measuring something that we call pressure front 2. And three of the instruments, the LECP that I mentioned, the plasma wave subsystem, and the magnetometer, all measured this pressure front 2, but CRS did not. So that made CRS a candidate to turn off on Voyager 1. And then Voyager 2 is in a slightly, well, it's in a different part of the very local interstellar medium where galactic cosmic rays and energy spectra are likely to be seen. So the types of things that the CRS can see are in the locale that Voyager 2 is in. So of course we wanted to keep it on, and so we're about to turn it off. We're turning it off in about 2 weeks.
Right, at the end of March. But this isn't the first time with the Voyager mission that systems have been turned off to conserve power, right?
Yeah, well, when we left the solar system, so there were certain instruments that really only were any good inside the solar system. So a good example is the cameras. So cameras need light. And when you're close to the sun, you've got sunlight. And so we use that sunlight to take, you know, pictures of the planets. And so each time we took a picture of a planet, you know, we're using the sun for that. But there's really, you know, not much to take pictures of out beyond the solar system. You know, the last image that we took was the famous pale blue dot.
That's one of my favorite images.
Right? So, you know, that's one of the last things that we took a picture of. So anyway, we turned off those instruments then. And actually, there was a lot of power back then. I think you may know that we use radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which are basically plutonium. Plutonium decays because it's radioactive. That's what it does. And when it decays, it gives off heat. And that heat is converted into electricity. That's how we get electricity for our spacecraft. But since we're using this fuel, if you will, this plutonium that's decaying, you know, every moment there's a little bit less of it. So our power supply every moment gets a little bit lessened, decays a little bit. So we always knew that we would run out of power. And we should be so lucky that nothing else gets us, that we get to the point that we don't have enough power to keep operating the mission. So we always knew that we would be turning off instruments. We've turned off everything that's non-essential. That's why we're finally turning off these instruments that are still gathering valuable science data. It's just we don't have anything else to turn off. There's nothing left.
So collectively, they traveled over 29 billion miles. When you think about it, I mean, I can't even wrap my head around that. 29 billion miles. The mission has been in place for decades. As somebody who's worked on the Voyager mission, you said something, it's the excitement in itself, the excitement of working on the mission. You obviously
hope to keep it going. But did you expect it to last this long? I mean, it's 2025.
When I look at the design documents, at the top of every document, there's a statement that is along the lines of, you know, we must design these parts to last at least 7 years. Everything had a 7-year design requirement, right? And 7 years would get you to past Saturn, right? I think we got to Saturn in 3 years, right? The idea was Jupiter and Saturn were the most important part of the mission. If we could get Uranus and Neptune, that would be fantastic. And anything else was, well, that's crazy talk. But yet, here we are in the crazy talk part of the mission. You know, we've been going for decades, 40, you know, we'll be 48 years this summer.
Right, almost 50 years, half a century almost.
And I think, especially after we left the planets, after the Neptune encounter in 1989, thinking was, geez, I don't think we can get very far. I don't think we'll last much longer. And, you know, we just haven't given up. You know, engineers love problems. We love working on this spacecraft and seeing what we get to do to keep it going a little further. And you mentioned 50 years. Now, that's become a goal of ours. Like, you know, darn it, let's see if we can get to 50 years.
Like you said, it's almost 50 years. I mean, this technology was launched decades ago. We think about aerospace technology today and how far we've come today. But even back then, this technology was built, you know, to last about 7 years. But as space exploration and science and technology have grown, Voyager has kind of grown with it. And the mission has almost been a symbol of that, of keeping some of that history alive.
Yeah, I think that with the Voyager mission, the reason it was launched in 1977 is there was this planetary alignment that only occurs once every 176 years. And a good way to think about it is the last time it occurred, I think Abraham Lincoln was the president, right? And so we had this opportunity in 1977 to visit all four planets of outer planets, that is Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune with one spacecraft. But we hadn't built many spacecraft and certainly nothing with that kind of scope. And so the original mission was, well, we better build more than one because what if one doesn't make it? You know, sure enough, both of them did make it. And I really think it was, you know, the designers and the builders really put their heart and soul and really did their best. Clearly, you know, they built these machines that are still flying 48 years later. And I think every time they had a design choice to make, they made the choice for the better part and the better design and the more challenging software that was more robust and things like that.
I'm also really hoping it makes it to 50 years.
Yeah, thanks.
But when that day does come, that maybe we have to shut down some of the other systems and other experiments, what happens then? What is there? Is there a plan for that in place? Or are we just still trying to keep a positive mindset on everything?
We are. I mean, as I said earlier, we should be so lucky that we get to the point that power is what gets us, that we just simply don't have enough power left. We have two other big problems. One is thermal. You know, just staying warm enough. You know, we use rocket fuel to hydrazine to control our pointing. So that's our thermal concern. And the nice thing, you know, especially as we turn off instruments and get more power into the bus, we get more warming. At this point, it seems like we're getting more warming than even power. So it seems like power is at the thinner margin than thermal. The other big problem we have is our thrusters. Our hydrazine is in a tank. And to push the hydrazine out of the tank, there's a silicone bladder. Silicone has been in contact with the hydrazine for 48 years. And it's working really well, but it leaches into the hydrazine. There's actually an upside to that. The upside is that it makes the freezing point a little lower. But the downside is it doesn't burn. So it deposits in the thrusters. So we have like a person has to worry about arterial sclerosis, blockages in the arteries. We worry about blockages in our thrusters. And so now we're fortunate on Voyager to have backup thrusters, but we've gone through our backups and we actually have backups. So there's three axes we control. So we control roll and pitch and yaw, the three axes. Roll, we have two branches. Pitch, we have three branches. Pitch and yaw, we have three branches because pitch and yaw originally had trajectory correction maneuver thrusters to be used for burns. So, you know, spacecraft have to make large corrections at various times. Our spacecraft don't need to do that anymore because we're leaving the solar system. We're not going in any particular direction, either of them. They're just going away. So we don't need to change their path. So we didn't need those TCM thrusters anymore. So we repurposed them to control pitch and yaw for us. And so the Voyagers are always Earth-pointed and always telemetering data. And so part of the day, if you go outside, part of the day, you're getting data from the Voyagers. You're bathing in data from the Voyagers. Well, and so we need to keep that pointing. But as the thrust, as we lose thrusters, and I went through this discussion of all these thruster branches we have, to also mention that all of them are degraded. All of them have problems. And, you know, all of them have some clogging, right? And so we're trying to figure out the best way to manage which thruster branch to be on at a time to get us to 50 years, honestly.
I mean, it's fascinating that there is a team of passionate scientists and engineers trying to preserve the Voyager mission, not only because it's fun, like you mentioned, by, you know, fixing a problem is fun, but also just to preserve that mission overall and the symbolism of it.
We're so lucky to be doing this because, you know, it's stuff that we love to do, but it also, you know, feels like it's bigger than me, you know, it's so much bigger than me.
And how long does it take for data to come back from Voyager 1 and 2 to Earth, or signals?
Yeah, so Voyager 1 is the furthest away, and it's more than 23 hours for the signal. So our signals move at light speed, right? And I guess it's really hard to wrap your head around it because there's not really, you don't really have that experience on Earth, you know? You turn on a light switch and there's light in the room, right? As soon as you hit the switch. But it actually takes the speed of light for the, you know, the switch actuator to reach your light and, you know, the electricity and all that. But light moves so fast that it's hard for us to get a sense of how fast it is. But if you think about the sun being 94 million miles away and it takes 8 minutes for light from the sun to reach us here at Earth, consider that it takes more than 23 hours for a signal to reach the Voyager 1 spacecraft from the Earth.
That's just mind-blowing to think about. The spacecraft is completely in interstellar space.
Yeah.
I mean, they're so far away, both of them. That's just fascinating, Kareem.
Right.
Kareem, thank you so much for joining us once again to talk about the Voyager mission, the mission update.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That was Kareem Badaruddin, the mission manager for the Voyager interstellar mission. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're at arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our host is Brendan Byrne. Our producer is me, Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. I'm Marion Summerall. Brendan will be back next week. Thanks for listening.